Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.
Coming up on Weekend America.
The presidential candidates are sprinting to Super Tuesday, but will the lack of sleep catch up with them?
Sleep is not like the bank. You cannot accumulate a debt across several days and then hope to pay it off at some later point in time by binging on sleep with recovery.
I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. For a tuba player in New Orleans, these are good times. Well, in a sense.
85% of the business here right now is playing for funerals and, you know, between the brass bands and the morticians, we're making the most money here now.
And while you're watching the Super Bowl commercials this weekend, raise a glass to the year 2000.
There was an internet world which was basically like a rock concert for dot-coms, and, you know, people were walking around requesting, you know, autographs on business cards and crazy things like that.
Whatever happened to the dot-coms of Super Bowl 34? That's coming up dot-com after the news.com.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke, is my name, in Los Angeles.
And in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Desiree Cooper. This Super Bowl weekend is much too early to be talking about free agents. But the free agents we meet this hour aren't on the gridiron. They're in the Big Easy, celebrating life and death with a brass band in New Orleans. So what are you doing this weekend?
Well, this weekend I'm doing a student-led worship.
This weekend, I am grading papers.
There's a bike race on Saturday.
I'm going to be participating in a mock trial.
Probably go do some trail running in the foothills.
This weekend, I'm going to Seattle for a friend's wedding.
Pretty much just nothing except for watch the Super Bowl.
I am spending the weekend in Boise. I've been to legislative days, and I'm having some R&R time to shop and relax.
Very good. And I assume that Seattle wedding is indoors because it's a very Seattle winter right now.
Those voices come from Denver, Colorado, Boise, Idaho, and Anchorage, Alaska.
Presidential contenders are storming the country this weekend, making a final push before Super Tuesday. And we often hear the complaint about media campaign coverage that there is too much focus on personalities, not enough on the issues. So we've decided to run a little experiment. We have taken the remaining candidates for president, given them pseudonyms, and written our own summaries of what they stand for. So as you prepare to vote, you don't need to worry about how anybody looks or how nice they were in the last debate. Just listen and decide whom you agree with. We will reveal the actual names at the end.
I'm Shirley Winslow, and I approve this message. A vote for Shirley Winslow is a vote against drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I also support a mandatory cap-and-trade system to reduce carbon emissions as a means of fighting global warming. I think there should be a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants, including learning English and paying fines, but I do support a fence on the Mexican border. I have promised affordable health care for every American in a Winslow administration, but I oppose a mandate to get there, and I think we can do it without raising taxes. Over in Iraq, I think we need more troops, and I oppose a timeline for withdrawal. When it comes to Iran, we should form an alliance with European countries to apply economic and diplomatic pressure. No military action without congressional approval. I'm Shirley Winslow, and thanks for your time.
I'm Fred Frazier, and I approve this message. I would abolish the Bush tax cuts for households earning more than $250,000 and use that money to fund health insurance for children. I believe illegal immigrants should have a path to citizenship. It might include paying some fines and learning the English language. And I've supported the construction of a fence along the Mexican border. We need to get out of Iraq, something a Frazier administration would accomplish by withdrawing one or two brigades a month, finishing within 16 months. I wouldn't rule out the use of force against Iran, but I would be perfectly willing to meet directly with Iran's president. I'm Fred Frazier, and I hope I've earned your vote.
I'm Vicki Hampton, and I approve this message. We've got to get rid of all federal income and payroll taxes and replace them with a 23% national sales tax on everything but education. That will happen in a Hampton White House. As far as healthcare goes, we can make it more affordable through tax credits and cost controls. I think we need to move away from fossil fuels and into a culture that embraces alternative energy sources within 10 years. To tackle the immigration issue, I say give illegal immigrants 120 days to register and then go back to where they came from, after which they can apply to return. I supported the idea of invading Iraq, and I oppose a timetable for troops to return. As for Iran, I favor direct diplomacy. I'm Vicki Hampton. Thanks for listening.
In case you're just tuning in, we are bringing you the actual platforms of the presidential candidates and using pseudonyms so you can choose based solely on the issues. So we've heard from Shirley Winslow, Fred Frazier, and Vicki Hampton. Let's keep rolling along here with Doris Franzi, Philip Gronko, and Lou Crandall.
I'm Doris Franzi, and I approve this message. I think corporations should have lower tax rates, and taxes on unearned income from middle-class families should be eliminated. The Franzi administration will take that business-friendly attitude into healthcare as well, favoring a free market, consumer-based system. In our quest for greater energy independence, I support alternative fuels, including biodiesel and ethanol, as well as nuclear power and drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I do not believe in giving illegal immigrants a path to citizenship, and I oppose a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. Oh, and I also support a constitutional amendment against gay marriage. I'm Doris Franzi. I'll see you in Washington.
I'm Philip Gronko, and I approve this message. On the subject of immigration, I support illegal immigrants learning English as part of a path to citizenship. But I also favor tougher penalties in a Gronko administration for those who hire illegal immigrants. And I support the construction of a fence along the U.S.-Mexican border. I think everyone in America should be required to have health insurance, even if it means that insurance is subsidized by the government. On the subject of Iraq, a Gronko presidency would mean a phased withdrawal within my first 60 days in office, with the goal of most troops being out by 2013. Meanwhile, in Iran, I would engage in direct diplomacy. I wouldn't rule out using force, but I would get congressional approval first. I support the death penalty, and I lobbied in favor of a bill that would expand the list of capital offenses. I'm Philip Gronko, and thanks for your support.
I'm Lou Crandall, and I approve this message. I think we should withdraw all troops from Iraq immediately and shut down Guantanamo Bay while we're at it. As for Iran, well, they have a right to nuclear weapons if they want them, and the Crandall administration will engage in direct diplomacy. Domestically, I think the economy can be improved by ending the war, balancing the budget, and getting rid of the income tax. Illegal immigrants should not have a path to citizenship, and I support the fence along the border. I'm firmly pro-life and also firmly opposed to the death penalty. I'm Lou Crandall. Thanks for your support.
Okay. Have you chosen your president? Let's see who you voted for.
I'm Shirley Winslow, and I'm John McCain.
I'm Fred Frazier, and I'm Barack Obama.
I'm Vicki Hampton, and I'm Mike Huckabee.
I'm Doris Franzi, and I'm Mitt Romney.
I'm Philip Gronko, and I'm Hillary Clinton.
I'm Lou Crandall, and I'm Ron Paul.
Well, are you surprised to find out who you actually support? A lot of people are. You can reread those platforms at our website, and we've got a survey where you can fill in your positions on issues and find out which candidate agrees with you the most. It's part of our project called American Public Media Engage 08, and it's at weekendamerica.org.
Well, I'll bet the candidates wish they could just spend this weekend getting some good old-fashioned shut-eye.
Yes, it's been grueling. The longest, most grueling campaign in memory. They started running earlier than ever before, and the nominees might still not be decided after Super Tuesday.
Yeah, it's amazing that all these exhausted candidates don't regularly just boil over, melt down, or go completely blank, especially when they've been campaigning through the night, like most of them have. So what exactly happens to the brain after months of sleep deprivation? To answer that, we turn to Matt Walker. He's the director of UC Berkeley's Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab. Matt, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
You know, the candidates this weekend are trying to figure out how best to cover 24 states. Can you talk to me a little bit about what the state of their minds must be like right now?
Well, if they're going under the condition of sleep deprivation, which I suspect many of them are, there are a number of unfortunate things that seem to happen to the brain that we know of. Firstly, the part of the brain that controls our logical, rational reasoning, which is a region called the frontal lobe, actually seems to be very sensitive to not getting enough sleep. And that region actually starts to shut down and become inhibited by the lack of sleep. So our ability to think logically is deteriorating the longer that we stay awake without sleep. Conversely, what also seems to happen that we've recently discovered is that the deep emotional brain centers actually start to ramp up and become perhaps dysfunctionally overactive without sleep. What we find is that your emotional rationality starts to become impaired and you become increasingly irrational in your emotional behavior. And your logical reasoning centers in the frontal lobe, which should normally take care and control of that type of situation, unfortunately are not online anymore and can't help out. They can't police the emotional brain.
Well, Matt, this weekend, people are going to be thinking about catching up on their sleep. So what's your advice to them?
When it comes to the question of sleep and memory, what we found is that, unfortunately, you can't pay back sleep in the way that you think about it. So in other words, sleep is not like the bank. You cannot sort of accumulate a debt across several days and then hope to pay it off at some later point in time by binging on sleep with recovery. Instead, it seems to be that after you've learned new information, you really have to sleep the first night after learning. And so if you pull the all-nighter after you've learned new information, and then you try and get all of the recovery sleep that you want on the second night and on the third night, when you test people for their memory several days later, that memory has not been retained anywhere near as well. So unfortunately, it seems that if you don't sleep within the first 24 hours after learning, you lose the chance for sleep to grab a hold of that new information and solidify it into the neural architecture of the brain.
Matt, if we're processing information most of the day and even well into the night, how are we processing information as we're sleeping?
One of the potential functions of sleep is to start to build connections and associations between newly learned pieces of information. It's almost like a group therapy session. You can imagine all of the new pieces of information that have been placed within the brain during that day at night sort of all gather around and start to try and introduce themselves to each other and figure out how they're related to one another. And by doing that, what you build are not only obvious connections between information, but perhaps novel connections between information. It turns out that colliding new pieces of information together in strange and odd ways is the basis of creativity. That's what we think about as a creative step in evolution, two things going together that should normally not go together, but the result is profoundly beneficial. You go to bed with the pieces of the puzzle and you wake up with the jigsaw complete. That's what we think sleep may be doing.
Well, Matt, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Matt Walker is the director of UC Berkeley's Sleep and Neuroimaging Lab. This weekend, he plans on getting some shut-eye after a long week of teaching.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Is this good news, bad news, or no news? A smaller presidential field, flat screens in the living room, and expressing your spousal anger. That's next on Weekend America. We'll be right back. You're listening to Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Super Bowls are great as long as they don't cut into our reflective time. Let's take a moment this weekend to review some of the news of the week and make the call as to whether it's good, bad, or not news. With us this time, performance artist Damali Ayo. Hey, Damali.
Hello, everyone.
Conservative commentator David Frum. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Writer and comedian Dana Gould. His credits include The Simpsons. Hey, Dana.
Hello.
Our first topic. It's not even Super Tuesday, and unless you count Dark Horse Mike Huckabee, we're down to two front runners in each party. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's good news.
Why is that?
Because people always complain about a lack of choices, but I don't think Americans want that many choices. You know, when I go down the potato chip aisle in the grocery store now, I'm paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
There's just too many snacks. And let's say five contenders for the presidency at this point. I think that's about all that people can handle. And they're all various shades of the same thing. On the Democratic side, it's basically a choice between turkey ham and turkey bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Republicans, it's turkey burger or turkey sausage. But that's why people want it.
Good news. Damali, David, do you agree?
It's good news for the Democrats. They're down to their two strongest candidates. It's bad news for the Republicans because the race has come out in a way that is going to be very, very divisive for the party and that is going to incite a lot of bad feeling. Races are won by the party that is most effectively able to unite around a consensus choice. I think Democrats are much better positioned to do that with the Obama-Clinton race than Republicans are going to be after the McCain-Romney race.
Even though we hear so much about Obama-Clinton sniping, Bill Clinton, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, they may despise each other personally, but I don't think their followers despise each other's followers, and that's the key point. Whereas you can see in the Republican race a high level of intense negativity from supporters of McCain against Romney, a high level of negativity from supporters of Romney against McCain. So the Republican Party is going to have a much more difficult time coming out of this united than the Democrats are.
Damali?
There is a bad news aspect of this with regards to why the candidates are dropping out. And, you know, a central flaw in the American political system right now is that people have to drop out when they stop being able to afford to run. And I think that is something that we do need to examine and we do need to fix eventually.
Our next topic. For Super Bowl weekend, the Washington Post brings us a trend story about the rise of the prominently displayed flat screen TV. Remember, it was once considered bad taste to display your boob tube and you'd hide it in a tasteful armoire. Well, is the new front and center over the fireplace television good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's no news. I think this is a trend that is going to last about 11 minutes.
Yeah.
Because the next big trend is that, like Dr. Evil, you're going to have a TV that at the press of the button ascends and descends. And that when that technology drops below $5,000, that's the thing everyone's going to want.
So the people with a flat screen TV over the fireplace are going to look really stupid really soon?
Yeah, they're going to look like people with the 8-track cassette recorders.
Okay.
Not at all. People are too lazy to actually send their TVs up and down like that. I have friends with DVRs who don't fast forward through the commercials. It makes no sense to me. So I think that years ago, the TV replaced the hearth in the home, and it hasn't moved anywhere since. So no news.
Yeah, I'm from a very blue-collar American family, and this story, the fact that people didn't feature their televisions, I found beguiling.
Oh?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've never lived in a home where the TV wasn't the center of the living room from day one.
Well, in an age of that we talk about too much media consumption and kids watching too much TV, it's a lot of people consider it tacky and materialistic and just lowbrow to have your TV, maybe in a family room or a den, but to have a big TV prominently in your living room. It's just, it's
tacky. Who are you talking to? Everybody does that. Just like
I don't know of anybody who doesn't have a TV.
I know. And this is why we have nicer looking TVs now, so that you can do that and still seem chic. Those people who think that, they're just buying more expensive televisions.
Well, I would, if given my choices, have a Velazquez in the place in the living room that is the center of attention.
And is it good news, bad news, or no news?
No news.
I think it's no news. It's like it might have been news, you know, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it will stay this way as long as a TV remains a better way than a painting to not talk to your family.
Yeah, right.
Okay, our final topic. In time for Valentine's Day, a University of Michigan study concludes that couples who suppress their anger die significantly younger than couples who express their anger. Does that sound like good, bad, or in fact no news?
Notable exceptions are the spouses of Phil Spector, O.J. Simpson, and Jerry Lee Lewis.
Fair enough.
But if that's true, I'd like to be the first to announce that I am immortal.
Yeah?
My wife and I will fight over who has more nothing.
Well, good for you. It feels like bad news for me because my wife and I, we try to let the little stuff go and live in harmony. And now I realize it's the harmony of death.
Well, that was my whole approach to marriage when I first got married. I thought that, you know, the way I would get through marriage is that my wife would do something that drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, when I have my opportunity, I'll die of a stroke. But that's not healthy.
Playing out that way.
I would suggest it's bad news, not in the sense that it's negative news, but it's bad news reporting. One of the things that drives me crazy about these soft features in the newspapers is this habit of reporting on scientific news before all the results are in.
Mm-hmm.
And if people, couples across America read this newspaper story and then feel empowered to yell at each other, that's probably not a positive development in anything. But it's also probably based on very provisional medical information. And I mean, my view on all of these stories is I'm going to wait until they're absolutely certain, and I don't want to read the news until all the returns are in.
It did make me wonder, how do you know when you're suppressing anger and when you're Buddha-like and not angry?
Not to take this non-story more seriously than, well, what the heck, we're taking it seriously.
Uh-huh.
This is the old what steam engine model of the brain that was very popular when steam engines were very popular, which is that the steam builds up, and if you don't let it out in some gradual way, you'll blow a gasket.
Right.
I don't know that it corresponds to any of our experience, that the right thing to do when your spouse or loved one irritates you is to let them have it. I think that may have inspired a lot of 1970s situation comedy set in therapist's office.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's the way to a long and happy life together.
I mean, I think that what you're doing, Bill, is to say, okay, so my spouse does something that bothers me. My guess is that she's probably let a few things that bothers her go too.
It's doubtful, but theoretically, yeah, theoretically, that could be true.
Your perfection enrages her.
And she lets it go.
That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Comedian Dana Gould. His credits include The Simpsons. Also, that was conceptual and performance artist Damali Ayo, who's the author of How to Rent a Negro. And David Frum's new book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
President Lyndon B. Johnson and Martin Luther King Jr., two great men, one date with destiny, coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper, here with Bill Radke. This weekend is the start of Black History Month, and we thought we'd take a look back at the working relationship between Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and President Lyndon B. Johnson. Both historical figures have been raised recently in the contest between Senators Clinton and Obama as they vie for the Democratic presidential nomination. But we thought, what about it? How did President Johnson and Martin Luther King actually work together? Joining us is historian Nick Kotz. He wrote a book called Judgment Days, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Laws That Changed America. Nick, welcome to Weekend America.
Oh, it's nice to be with you, Desiree.
Now, Nick, why don't we start by listening in on a conversation between President Johnson and Martin Luther King,
this Lyndon Johnson, I had a call,
recorded on January 15th, 1965.
We've got to come up with the qualification of voters. That will answer 70% of your problems.
That's right.
If you just clear it out everywhere, make it age and read and write.
Nick, what's going on in this conversation?
Well, Desiree, it's a wonderful conversation. This was Dr. King's 36th birthday. President Johnson called him up to congratulate him on his birthday, but he really called him up so they could put their heads together and figure out how to pass the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And at the time they had that conversation, the law was going nowhere in the Congress. The Southerners were blocking it. And the bit we just listened to was Johnson telling Dr. King that if we get this voting rights law passed, this will solve a lot of your problems, and the Southern politicians will be coming to you. The point was, if African Americans had the vote in the South, it would empower them in ways that could hardly be imagined. Dr. King answered by saying, and President Johnson, if the blacks get registered in the South, you'll be able to carry the five Southern states that you lost in the 64 election.
That's a pretty powerful strategic session. It makes me wonder, how closely did the two actually work together?
Particularly from the moment that President Kennedy was killed in November of 63, through the passage of the Voting Rights Act in August of 1965, there was a fascinating working relationship between Johnson and King. They were not natural allies, and yet they needed each other. Johnson needed King to stir the country, to put pressure on in the streets, and King needed Johnson, who was a master at legislation, to get Congress to pass the law.
Nick, as a historian, listening back to these great giants in history talking, what does that bring up for you?
What it makes me think of is these were really giant leaders. They were giant leaders in a number of respects, and I'm talking about both Dr. King, President Johnson, the Republican leaders in Congress, the Democratic leaders in Congress. They were dealing with momentous issues. The Voting Rights Act was passed. The 64 Civil Rights Act was passed. But beyond that, Medicare, Medicaid, there were 15, 20 momentous laws that really fundamentally changed the relationship between the federal government, the states, and the people. And all of them were enacted in this brief window. And during this moment, it was a time for great leadership. They had the vision, they had the ability, and they had the will. When you listen to them talk and you see what they did, it makes you wonder, will we have that kind of leadership again?
So that's what we got to do now, and you get in there and help us.
Well, I certainly will. You know, you can always count on that.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Nick, thank you for sharing this insight with us.
You're very welcome.
Nick Kotz has a book called Judgment Days, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Laws That Changed America. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and this is the radio show about This American Weekend. This is Mardi Gras weekend in New Orleans, and that means full employment for the city's brass bands. Musicians will spend the hours between now and early Wednesday morning playing at clubs and parties and parades all over the city. The Hurricane Katrina flooding forced a lot of established bands to leave New Orleans. Reporter Joel Rose wanted to know how the surviving bands are doing.
When I meet up with the free agents at 5 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, they're already on their third gig of the day. This one is a house party in the 8th Ward, in a neighborhood of faded shotgun houses near the I-10 overpass. About 24 people are gathered on a front porch for a repast, meaning a birthday party for someone who died in the past year. For the next 20 minutes, the band leads a parade through the neighborhood. Nobody explains the route. The revelers just follow the band without putting down their drinks, dancing between potholes and the occasional oncoming car. Some are wearing custom-made t-shirts with the name and picture of the deceased, who looked to be a young man in his 20s. The free agents are done so quickly, I don't even catch the name of the guy who died. Before I get a chance to ask, we're in the car on the way to the band's next gig.
Did you know this guy?
No, I don't. That's 85% of the business here right now is playing for funerals and, you know, between the brass band and the morticians, we're making the most money here now.
John Cannon plays tuba for the free agents.
You know, it's just a natural thing, and that's the way they celebrate the life of a human being here in New Orleans. It's a celebration, and you celebrate the life of the person rather than you mourn the death.
And that celebration traditionally requires a brass band. They also play for parades, wedding receptions, and birthday parties. The Free Agents' next gig tonight is Crew de Vue, the first official parade of the Mardi Gras season. But Cannon says Saturdays are always a party in New Orleans.
I think we have a couple of gigs after this parade we're about to play. It doesn't stop. It doesn't stop at all.
How many gigs do you play on a Saturday usually?
Busy Saturday, we might work from maybe 7 in the morning to about 2 the next morning.
Cannon grabs his well-traveled tuba out of the back of his truck, and we head off to wait for the rest of the band at the start of the parade route near the Mississippi River below the French Quarter. A brass band requires a lot of players, 2 or 3 trumpets, 2 trombones, a saxophone, and 2 drummers. After Katrina, most of the brass bands here were scattered all over the country. That's when the free agents got together. Their biggest problem wasn't getting gigs, it was finding places to live. Trumpeter and co-founder Shannon Haynes commutes from the other side of Lake Pontchartrain.
I stayed in New Orleans East. It was totally destroyed. I had 11 feet of water in my house. I wound up selling the house and moving further away. I stay in Slidell, Louisiana, now about 40 miles away from here. And I travel back in and out daily, you know. That's all we could do right now.
Before the storm, tuba player John Cannon lived in a house in the lower 9th Ward. For now, he's renting a different place. He says he'd like to fix up his house and move back in, but it would be too expensive to do that.
I'm still paying homeowners insurance on a house that I can't live in because it's required. But if I put one piece of fresh drywall up, now I qualify for have to have flood insurance. So it's like, you know, it's 6 in one hand, half a dozen in the other.
The free agents aren't getting rich doing this, but they are getting paid well tonight. The Crew de Vue is known for that. It's also famous for wicked social satire and for floats so obscene I can't even describe them on the air. The free agents are marching in front of a papier-mâché tank with the words Extended Tour of Booty on the side and a giant papier-mâché penis for a cannon pointed right at us.
That's hard.
Oh, man, you crazy.
Working hard as a tank, boy.
Even before the parade starts, everyone in the crowd is getting louder and more drunk. The free agents pass around a bottle of rum, among other things. After the flood, the band's drummer and co-founder Ellis Joseph spent a few months in Atlanta. He says this kind of scene is why he had to come back to New Orleans.
The music really does something for us. It's like our healing, you know what I'm saying, for the people in the city. All this shit we went through, man, you had to see the first time we played for people that hadn't heard a band in a while. Oh, man, it's like they just let everything out.
We'll It'll take the free agents more than an hour to march a couple miles up to the French Quarter and the end of the parade. After that, they've got two more gigs to play before they call it a night. In New Orleans, I'm Joel Rose for Weekend America.
On Sunday, millions of fans are going to crowd into bars and living rooms to watch the New England Patriots face off against the New York Giants in the Super Bowl. The Patriots are taking the field after an undefeated season. For those few hours, a huge swath of the country goes tribal. They don their favorite team's colors. They taunt friends and coworkers who root for the opposing team. Is it all over the top? Well, not compared to some people. Reporter Shannon Mullen found a Patriots fan in Laconia, New Hampshire, who's let the team's record-setting success go straight to his head.
Victor Thompson's an average guy, from the eyebrows down, but we'll come back to that. He hangs out at the House of Tattoos, up the street from an old mill building and a funeral home. He doesn't work all winter, but in the summer he installs people's docks on the lake nearby, and he admits he's never had much of a goal in life.
I don't know, I just went with the flow. Whatever happened, happened.
It was during a particularly low point recently that Victor decided to dedicate himself. He was serving 3 months in prison for assault, but his favorite football team, the New England Patriots, was having a record season.
You know, I was in there, sitting there incarcerated, and the third game in the season, I was watching. Everybody's got hats, shirts, you know, and stuff like that. And I says, you know what I want? I want the Brady's helmet tattooed on my head.
As in Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. Over the past month, Victor's had all the symbols from Brady's helmet tattooed on his shaved head. He has the team's Minuteman logo wrapping around both temples. And across the base of his skull, an American flag, Brady's number 12 in the middle, and the NFL logo. He's trying to convince his wife, Barbara, to let him do more.
If I had my way, I'd put the whole silver helmet and the face mask. But she told me if I do the face mask, I get a divorce. So I can't go that far.
He could cover that up. He can cover the head up.
No.
The face you can't cover up.
I'll be ready for Halloween. I won't need a mask.
Even with his helmet head, Victor will probably never pass for Tom Brady, who's a star athlete. And Victor's, well, Victor. But he says that doesn't matter. After hours under the needle and $1,000 in the hole, he feels like a true patriot.
I have their team emblem on me now. Now they can't forget me. Now, anytime they think of number 12, they're going to say, what about 12 in New Hampshire? That guy's wearing it on his head. Well, that's me, Vic Thompson. That's what I wanted to do, and I did it.
If the Pats win the Super Bowl, Victor wants to add a tattoo of the trophy to the top of his head. And he's hoping Tom Brady will come to Laconia, take up the tattoo needle himself, and complete Victor's helmet with an autograph. In Laconia, I'm Shannon Mullen for Weekend America.
Victor Thompson's head is a work in progress. It'll get more intricate if the Patriots win on Sunday, so you better peek at it now. Actually, the tattoo is awesome. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Oh, for Victor's sake, New England Patriots, please don't trade. Do not trade Tom Brady to another team. Des, you're going to watch the Super Bowl?
Yeah. I mean, it's really one of my favorite times of the year. I love watching the game. And like most America, I like the commercials, too. You know, I was noticing this year that Tide is even going to be advertising for the first time. And it's sort of an acknowledgement that women make up 40% of the Super Bowl audience. What I think about there is that it's interesting that advertisers have to really target their pitches so that they're not alienating one gender while they're trying to enlist the other one. It's like the Super Bowl is no longer an all-boys club.
Here's what makes me curious, Des. I know a lot of Americans are rooting for the Patriots to
complete to cap their glorious season of perfection. And that makes total sense to me, but I'm rooting for the underdog, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't want them to be perfect. And I wonder, what does that preference say about us psychologically?
Yeah, well, you know what? I didn't feel like I had a dog in this hunt, so that's exactly how I decided who I was going to root for. Do I want to see perfection or do I want to see grit? I went with the grit, mm-hmm. New York. But I did feel this twinge of guilt. It's like, why not hope for something to be perfect these days?
Right. It's like two American values opposing each other on the field on Sunday. There's being the very best at something versus pulling yourself from behind. Mm-hmm. And may the best team win. This is Weekend America.
For those of you who have tickets, you'll have a nice Super Bowl in Arizona, about 60 degrees, with a slight chance of showers. Be grateful it could be snow. For more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
Snow, 30 degrees. Who's up for some golf? Phillips, Wisconsin. You know, I prefer to use a standard Wisconsin instead of the Phillips, but that's just me. It's a 9-hole course where your $20 registration also gets you a warm bowl of chili after your day on the links, provided you find the links. Extra prizes if you wear skis, extra chili if you just stay inside. Snowflake Arizona is getting literal with its name, offering snow and 44 degrees at its annual Groundhog Day breakfast. They're serving up sausage gravy and groundhog biscuits, which we hope is not nearly as literal as the snow in Snowflake. All eyes will be watching as the groundhog emerges and says, "Whoa, this is not Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania." Helvetia, West Virginia is no stranger to Old Man Winter. This weekend he brings clouds and 43 degrees, but he doesn't know he's getting burned at the stake. At Fasnacht, an effigy of Old Man Winter is set ablaze at midnight to celebrate the end of the season. It's fun for the whole family, provided the family is thirsty for mob violence. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
You put the big money on for the Super Bowl? Procter & Gamble or Budweiser? A look at the real big game, coming up on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, welcome to Super Bowl weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Tomorrow in Glendale, Arizona, the Patriots will attempt to make history. If they win Super Bowl 42... they'll be the first team since the 1972 Miami Dolphins to go the entire season without a loss. But for Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder, 1972 is not the most memorable year in football. It's the year 2000, Super Bowl 34. because for Charlie, the big game isn't so much about who wins or loses. It's about the commercials.
Okay, before I start, I need to put things in perspective here. In January of 2000, Y2K, my bad, things were dot-com crazy.
There was a internet world, which was basically like a rock concert for dot-coms. And, you know, people were walking around requesting, you know, autographs on business cards and crazy things like that.
That's Mike Ford. He's one of the guys that started Computer.com, a help site for, shall we say, people who couldn't tell the difference between a mouse and a modem. In 1999, he and his partner, Mike Zaplin, raised $7 million to start Computer.com. Then they spent half that money on Super Bowl ads.
We had just taken the money, the venture capital money, in November and had 6 weeks to produce an advertising campaign where Doritos and Mountain Dew had been working on it for 11 months. We had 6 weeks.
Basically, we went to the ad agency.
That's Mike Zaplin, but you can call him Zappy.
And they gave us the pitch of the 10 different commercials that they thought, and Ford and I just kind of looked at each other and we said, where's the one we're in?
Mike and Mike and their advertising agency agreed on a campaign that combined elements of a Woody Allen movie and an ad that you'd expect to see from a local car dealer. And then they were off.
So the commercials start off with Mike and Mike, the company founders.
Disregard Mike's third-person point of view here. He's talking about himself and Zappy.
Holding up a sign saying, Computer.com, 1-800-COMPUTER.
Last year, two men bravely launched Computer.com.
And then it cuts away to one of Mike's relatives or someone Mike knows. We're not sure which Mike.
Computer.com sells and explains computer stuff.
And then them telling the story about Computer.com.
Take your pills!
At the end, it comes back to Mike and Mike holding up the sign and asking people to come to the site or call the phone number.
Computer.com. Computer stuff. Computer stuff explained.
Welcome to Atlanta as the crowd settles in for Super Bowl 34, St. Louis against Tennessee.
Now, that year I watched the Super Bowl with a bunch of my friends. Now, none of us cared that much about the game, but when the commercials came on, we all turned to the TV, only to find out that it had been taken over by dot-coms. Remember these? Pets.com, Lifeminers.com, Hotjobs.com, Kforce.com, OurBeginning.com, LastMinuteTravel.com, Epidemic.com, NetPliance.com. It got so bad that at one point we were convinced a commercial would soon air for a company called dot-com.com. Meanwhile, Mike Ford and his 12-person staff monitored Computer.com's web traffic from their Boston headquarters. Zappy? The network gave him tickets on the 50-yard line and an invitation to watch his commercial from the Disney booth.
So I went up there, and it was a very surreal moment. Up in the Disney booth, there was Michael Eisner and Joe Namath and John Travolta, and it was just, you know, a few advertisers that were there. And each time somebody's commercial went off, everybody in the booth knew what was going on, so they'd be patting everybody on the back.
Because Mike and Mike bought their ads so late, they got the worst possible slot. Toward the end of the game, at the two-minute warning, when most people would have tuned out. But this year was different. The game was a real nail-biter. At the two-minute warning, St. Louis led by only a touchdown.
1:54 left. Titans will get the ball with one timeout, down by seven.
As 140 million people sat on the edge of their seats, ABC went to commercial. That's when the Computer.com ad ran.
Last year, two men bravely launched Computer.com.
And I remember the president, it was Iger at the time of Disney, and he looked at me and he said, I don't know if you have a horseshoe up your ass, but that was the highest rated commercial of all time.
Things could not have been better. But then, well.
The Dow closed down 617 points for the day, the largest point drop ever. The NASDAQ.
I didn't know the bubble was going to burst quite as fast as it burst, but I'll never forget I was standing with somebody on a balcony in Miami Beach and talking about what was going on, and they were a dentist, and they were saying, oh, yeah, I'm putting together a hedge fund. And I literally in that moment thought to myself, my God, if my dentist is talking about starting a dot-com anything, then this is just spiraling way too fast.
10 months after launching their company with a Super Bowl ad, Mike and Mike sold Computer.com to Office Depot.
I've been through it back and forth in my mind. You know, could we have done this differently or that differently? But, you know, the bottom line was, you know, we executed appropriately for that moment in time.
After Computer.com, Mike Ford worked in sales and helped launch a couple companies, but it wasn't quite the same. Meanwhile, Zappi continued to buy generic URL names. That is, when he wasn't lecturing on Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah.
You know, Kabbalistically, there are ways that the universe works, and if you can plug into those, you're going to help yourself, advance yourself, and at the same time, have a lot less chaos.
He even has a website for it, Kabbalah.com, which will not be airing a commercial during Super Bowl 42. For Weekend America, I'm Charlie Schroeder.
If you don't remember .coms, you can see all their commercials. Refresh your memory at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Well, that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our show is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Nelia Lell, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, E. Akobi, who's going to try to fit in the Super Bowl and a group meditation this weekend. Also, Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bomba, who's either running a half marathon or talking existentialism in a coffee shop.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Shirley Shen, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, who's decluttering his house for his impending move from Seattle to St. Paul, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You deserve to have a convenient and portable version of it. And you can do that by getting a podcast for free at our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there and have a super duper weekend.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. This program is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. The weekends are for freedom.
Our job is to liberate them from the sensibilities and the conventions of their day-to-day life.
Now I just walk down the street and I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird.
Forget the chores, the errands, and the weekend runaround. Liberate yourself with Weekend America, where great radio lives on the weekend.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.